Good morning, Indie Bay. This is David Grace in San Francisco. It's going on 8 o'clock on a Thursday morning. In the last few weeks, there have been efforts by the public employees, especially governmental employees working for the EPA, and this is a huge cross-section of different scientists who have put together various petitions to the Bush administration, and apparently the number of these EPA employees totals approximately 9,000. Employees who have put together a petition demanding that the Bush administration cease abusing science. Essentially, what the Bush administration is doing is declaring that politics supersedes science. So obviously, that's a dangerous principle. And on the phone with us is Jeff Rook. He's a representative of the Public Employees Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. And while we do this interview, you could look up their organization, peer.org, P-E-E-R.org. Welcome, Jeff. Tell us what this is all about.
Good morning. It's a revolt of the scientists. An unprecedented number of scientists, 9,000, and virtually the entire technical staff that has anything to do with pesticides has signed on to a letter of protest in which they say that their agency, under political influence, is cutting scientific corners to approve very powerful pesticides that threaten the nervous systems of those that come in contact with them, particularly those in factories and where the pesticides are mixed and fields where they're applied to crops.
Okay, so the petition effort or this letter, the 9,000 scientists, this really only involves chemicals as opposed to, I was under the impression that it also involved kind of the totality of the Bush administration in denying global warming existed or...
No, actually, we're working on a separate one on global warming with the EPA scientists. This actually has to do with a decision that's upcoming to permanently approve some 20 very powerful pesticide agents that are called organophosphates. The most prominent one, at least out in California, is malathion, which was used to spray for the medfly. Methyl bromide is another one that's applied to the strawberry and some of the other fields in California.
Right, and methyl bromide actually is a known, not only is it a carcinogen, but it also destroys the ozone layer?
It does have that feature, and they all come from a family of chemicals that were derived from nerve agents developed during World War II. And the central health concern is one of what's called neurotoxicity, damage to the nervous system. And it's particularly acute when infants, pregnant women, children in developmental stages are exposed to it. And in this case, EPA has ignored the warnings of their own independent science advisory board, and they've also brushed by the problems that have been pointed out by their own inspector general, which says the agency has not developed the information to make this decision. But the scientists inside the agency have been told, nonetheless, these agents are going to be approved, hence the letter of protest.
You know, this is interesting. I've done a number of interviews with attorneys, and as a matter of fact, we did an interview with one of the candidates for Attorney General for California just yesterday, and we were talking about the principle, of course, the Constitution grants us the right to be declared innocent until proven guilty, and as you're maybe you're aware that the some years ago corporations were given corporate personhood. This is something Ralph Nader's talked about forever, and as such, corporations then are given this same right, innocent until proven guilty. But as this is done, they're essentially declaring that certain chemicals can also be given this innocence until proven guilty. And so the idea that known carcinogens, known toxics, known heavy metals can be innocent until proven guilty is a very dangerous principle. Is this a part of the letter?
Not so much. I mean, these chemicals have already been found guilty. In essence, they're on probation. And the reason that they're still on the market and waiting this final decision is because Congress intervened 10 years ago. And The Clinton administration in the mid-90s was in the process of banning these chemicals. The industry rose up, and at the time the Republicans controlled, and still do, both houses of Congress, and they forced a compromise. And the compromise was a 10-year probationary period during which EPA was supposed to do additional studies on these chemicals and then make a final decision. That final decision is due August 3rd this year. And what the scientists are saying is that the studies haven't been done. EPA has decided in sort of the face of what science has been done, in essence, that the books are cooked. And that's what's going on. So this is, if to use a criminal justice analogy, chemicals have already been found guilty, and they've been found to violate their terms of probation, but they're going to be let free anyway.
Right, and under many states, they're putting together new tort reform. If people are not familiar with the expression tort, those are lawsuits, injury lawsuits quite often. And so if you're injured on the job by chemical burns or inhaling some kind of nasty chemical in the workplace or various polluters down the block or in your town are poisoning you, under normal injury law, you have to prove a dollar value how much you're injured. So if you're unemployed and you can't show any lack of employment losses, no sick days, and then if you're unemployed and you have no health care, and you have to go down to the county hospital, and the county essentially pays your bills, you're not able to show receipts for your injuries. So you may get zero, even though you come down with a cancer that can be directly attributed to the injuries of these chemicals. So in previous years, before many of these states put together tort reform, you at least could get some compensation for these injuries. But under the Republican or Repugnocrat, let's say, versions of tort reform, your ability to sue for being poisoned by these guilty chemicals is going to be whittled away as well. So definitely the public should keep their eyes out for any attempts to change tort law unless it's to make it stronger.
Well, as these scientists point out, the people most at risk are farm workers and their children, probably a group that is the least likely to even be able to consider bringing a tort lawsuit. The letter talks about the failure to consider exposure to neurotoxic pesticides by infants and children who commonly enter fields treated with these pesticides while accompanying their parents. And those are really basic public health concerns. These scientists are protesting that their employing agency, which is supposed to be serving us, is ignoring.
So in an accidental way, the anti-immigrant furor that's being stirred up, if it helps keep these poor people out of the farms, it may actually save their lives. They not only will be underpaid and poisoned, but they will also, as immigrants, not have any standing, so to speak, in the U.S. courts, because trying to sue someone if you're declared an illegal immigrant, you would not necessarily have the right to or the courage to sue in the courts. So it might actually be to someone's benefit to refuse to work in these farms until this is...
While they're on the front line, there are going to be residues of these chemicals on the crops that will make their way to our dinner tables.
Sure, sure. Well, this is an interesting aspect of it. Many Americans, if they're given even a modicum of chemistry in junior high school or high school, are well aware of the pesticides and not to stand under the airplanes when they're spraying through the fields and not to enter the fields if they smell very strange, and to wear protective clothing. But if you're an immigrant and you're feeling lucky just to get a job for the day, you may not have the courage to speak up against going into a strange smelling environment. And, it is a very great hazard. Now, tell us about the cross-section of these 9,000 scientists. This is pretty amazing.
We've never seen anything like it. And they're represented by unions from California to Washington, D.C. And one of the things that is striking about it is that these scientists are so upset by the twisting of scientific principles that they consider it a working condition that's a bargainable issue. The agency is refusing to bargain about it, which is why they've chosen this kind of extra collective bargaining mechanism of writing this petition. But we've never seen these many scientists agree on this sort of issue and rise up publicly in protest.
Yeah, well, it's pretty profound. Now, there are courageous unions and there are lackadaisical unions. Is there this pretty much a groundswell from the bottom up, or is it also?
Yes, a number of the scientists that were involved in putting this thing together are members of our organization. We're a nonprofit group. And it really has been one of these things that it's come from, if you will, the cubicles, which are the grassroots of the agency, to the headquarters. This took a long time to put together, but it's been a very powerful statement. For example, it generated a front-page article in the Wall Street Journal, one that ordinarily covers EPA scientific issues.
Right. Now, I've been running into a cross-section of different scientists and economists and agricultural economists who have been looking at this idea of organics and helping create as you may know, in many states, especially California, if you want to turn a formerly a chemical-laden farm into an organic farm, it can take a minimum of 7 years, probably 20 years, for many of these chemicals to dissipate enough to be able to achieve the organic standards. Now, obviously, many of the big corporations are trying to change the organic standards so that they can declare a farm organic in 2 years or in 5 years or, you know, a reduced amount of time. I'm wondering if you, if a cross-section of these, first of all, have you got much knowledge of these attempts to change the organic standards and whether or not...
Only from the employees within the U.S. Department of Agriculture that have told us about it. We're a service organization for employees, and the way we get involved is employees inside these agencies that are under these pressures or in a whistleblower situation or threatened for not suppressing information, they come to us. We're kind of a giant battered staff shelter.
Right. Well, and that was leading up to another question. Are these 9,000 scientists at risk of their jobs or their academic futures if they take part in this? Obviously, we'd need to protect them. Or, and this kind of was the beginning of the first question, of these 9,000 farmers, if they lose their jobs, would there be a way that we could just transfer them into the future economy, an economy of cleanup? Obviously, if many of these scientists know about the interaction of chemicals, then there must be ways that we can dilute or transfer toxics into less harmful agents.
Well, on the issue of legal protection, we were the ones that gave them the legal advice to use this particular venue. In some large part, I don't know what you heard about the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision on government workers' free speech. And what that decision said is that when government workers at all level are speaking as public employees within the scope of their duties, they're not covered by the First Amendment. They actually have the constitutional status similar to that of prisoners. And that they have First Amendment protection only when they speak as citizens outside of their normal duties. this letter through the unions is above and beyond the call of duty, well above, and is protected by the First Amendment. I don't think there's going to be an effort to fire all 9,000 of these employees. It's about half of all of the scientists that work at EPA, and that would, if they do something like that, I think you'll be hearing more about it. But suffice it to say, it's not a, you know, considered a career advancement move. One portion of the letter talks about how people, the scientists in the pesticide program, quote, feel besieged by political pressure exerted by agency officials too closely aligned with the pesticide industry and former EPA officials now representing the pesticide and agricultural community. And most of the lawyers and lobbyists for the industry are former EPA officials, and by way of reciprocity, most of the top officials within EPA are former lawyers and lobbyists for industry as well.
Well, what I was kind of leading up to is that it would seem to me that we need to have a complete reversal of the standard economic paradigm. For example, if you had an acre of land that was a hazardous waste dump, if the average price of an acre of land in that region was, say, $100,000 an acre, but it was going to cost you $10 million to clean it up, after you spend $10 million, what are you left with but $100,000 acre? So under standard economics, it's not cost-effective to clean it up, ergo it's not cost-effective to save your life. And that said, even if we have the knowledge to clean it up, is there a body of people willing to work on these cleanups and resolve these the sins of our fathers, so to speak? It's kind of interesting. Some years ago, maybe as long ago as 30 years ago, back in St. Louis, there was an organization that was chartered by the local Chamber of Commerce. It was called the Regional Growth, I think it was the Regional Growth and Commerce Agency. And what they had done was a trade of hazardous waste. So that, in other words, if a company was discharging a hazardous waste or a, you know, just some raw material that was a waste product, that a byproduct of their manufacturing process, it may be a good raw material for another company, and that this would be a logical way to deal with hazardous waste, that another company could buy it and use it as part of their manufacturing process. The whole idea, though, fell apart because of patent law. If one company was able to look at another company's hazardous wastes, they could determine how they were manufacturing their initial product, and then they could make generic versions of that product, or they could steal their manufacturing process. And so the various companies were afraid to take part in the exchange of waste products, because of the fear of losing their patent control. And there were attempts to, with this RCGA, put together a secretive body, so to speak, that would then transfer the hazardous waste through a secret process so that you wouldn't necessarily know which company it came from, and ergo you wouldn't know what was the manufacturing process. It would be more difficult to tail it, but even that had apparently some legal responsibilities.
I was going to comment, the transfers that we see from these companies are campaign contributions. Today we did a release. We have a chapter in New Jersey, and what is going on there, and as you may know, New Jersey has one of the highest number as well as concentration of contaminated sites in the United States, is that in order to avoid the cost of cleaning them up, they have induced the state to so relax the standards and come up with loopholes so that they can basically leave the toxics in place. In some cases, just putting some sort of cover on them and calling them clean and redevelop them. So you have a number of scandals in New Jersey, which so far has not been enough to stimulate any kind of real reform, in which in some cases highly toxic soil is being used as fill on community developments, schools, and nursing homes. When it's discovered, it's everyone's sort of embarrassed, but they go back and keep doing what they're doing. So it's far cheaper for these companies to pay politicians to put pressure on the agencies to water down the standards or not enforce.
Well, and that's why I brought up the structure of tort, where if a person is unemployed, if they're a child, they're unemployed. If they are working into a world where wages are going to be reduced, they will have, and the cost of medical care is going to vastly increase. Under standard tort, you have to prove receipts in order to get compensation for damages.
And you have to prove causation, which
exactly,
is
yeah.
a major, I don't know whether you remember the book and movie that starred John Travolta, Civil Action, and it was about what a monumental operation it was to bring a lawsuit against the company W.R. Grace, which has been responsible for some of the most amazing chemical atrocities in this country. That resulted in a very mixed result. These suits are extremely hard to bring, and the chance of being made whole through one of them is akin to the chances of winning the lottery.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, we were lucky enough to disown him long ago. I am actually, my true last name is Grace, but that's, yeah, and Dick Cheney was dumb enough to buy W.R. Grace's damages with the... with Halliburton, if I remember right, and got very much caught up in the asbestos lawsuits of that. Yeah, that's the economics of cleanup is such a horror. And it's interesting because not only is this idea of 9,000 scientists getting actively, involved in some sort of remediation, a recognition that this is a hazard that can't be ignored, but that if we are going to walk wide-eyed into such a danger as to allow toxics to be innocent until proven guilty, then it's suicide not only for a nation but for the planet. So it's a great courage, and the reason I brought up the economics of it is that if we're going to have someone so foolish as to have as the president and this Congress is going to allow a situation like this to happen, then the economics is going to be faulty in its totality. So in other words, the wages and salaries that these 9,000 scientists are getting they can't even begin to compensate. So that said, it would seem to me that the paradigm shift should be going that these 9,000 employees should make themselves available to the rest of the society for cleanup. The opportunity, we definitely have an opportunity to clean this up. We have a lot of people who have got skills and knowledge.
These scientists already work for us. What they're protesting is they're not being allowed to do their jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
And it would be far more direct to just end the political interference and let them do their jobs and report the science accurately. There's more than enough work that they should be doing. They don't have to quit and find other things to do. The number of new chemicals introduced into the mainstream American Congress is on the order of more than 1,500 a year. These are the scientists that are supposed to be looking at those and flagging where there are dangers and whether there ought to be restrictions on the application of some of these chemicals.
Yeah, now that actually, yeah, it's good you brought that up. There are 1,500 new chemical compounds being tossed on the market with essentially no review.
Right, and there is no law that requires, except for very limited purposes, for example, they're used as pesticides, that they be at all reviewed. A good example are the family of chemicals that were introduced by 3M and DuPont in products like Teflon and Scotchgard that have now been linked to cancer, as well as they don't break down, and so that they're bioaccumulating and they're being found in very high concentrations in fish and other wildlife in what are supposed to be pristine places like the Boundary Lakes in upper Minnesota.
Right. Right, and that said, by the way, have you ever run into the book Our Stolen Future? They also have a website, ourstolenfuture.org.
No.
It's a great website. It's a great resource. The book came out, I think, 1999. It was put together by four different cross-section of different scientists, and they're essentially laying out how as we work into a very technological world, we have to have people who are smart enough to be able to keep this technological world going. But unfortunately, these same chemicals that you're just describing are causing the ADD, the chemical damages both to our physical bodies and our minds. And so the more chemical laden we become as humans and as creatures on this planet, the shorter our lifespans become, and the need to take control of these same chemicals, which may have a lifespan, you know, just simple plastics, the plastics that you tear off a CD or the bag that you pick up vegetables in the grocery store may last 350 years. We have to have scientists who will know how to cause the recycling or the dismantling of these different types of chemicals. And the more toxics we dump into our environment, the more we're killing our children so that they're not going to be growing up for a long enough lifespan to be able to have enough institutional memory to be able to work on the extreme lifetimes of many of these chemicals. And the website, ourstolenfuture.org, just daily they add in more and more research project results. And so they're always adding in a variety of different types of studies that are verifying this whole insane economic and chemical nightmare.
And while science is indispensable, without laws and policies that put this into some sort of framework, all the science in the world won't stop us from remaining at the mercy of corporate R&D efforts. So as long as these things can be introduced on a broad scale into the environment, regardless of what the science says, then nothing will change.
Right, and probably one of the biggest hazards of this thing is the patent laws that is essentially demanding that if you want to retain your patent, I guess in the old days it used to be 17 years, and then there was an extension to 34 years and various, and now it's been extended even to 100 years and whatnot, but that they make variations on a chemical. And so
right.
This would be a part of your, as you mentioned, what, 1,500 new chemicals every year. So if you, for example, had, say Bazooka Joe bubblegum wrappers, and for the last 100 years they've always been made out of the same kind of plastic. But if they want to retain their patent rights on that type of plastic, they have to make it just slightly different every 34 years in order to make sure that they hold their patent rights. And so that demands that there become a new chemical introduced into the environment that has never been seen before on the planet. And obviously there are no bugs or critters that can eat that new type of product, and so it cannot biodegrade. And so we're going to end up with Bazooka Joe paper wrappers for the next 10,000 years on the planet.
And you extend that to the world of environmental regulation, and also extend the criminal justice metaphor, is that even where one of these public agencies can identify problems with one particular chemical, by the time they get that done, the company can just introduce a variation of the chemical, and then the process starts all over again. And so it would be like a criminal being convicted and getting out of jail because he can change his name.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's a horror. And as a matter of fact, that happens in the world of accounting fraud all the time. We're definitely seeing it with things like Enron. Yeah, so it very much looks like an act of sabotage on the parts of many of these chemical companies. They have no desire to be responsible. They act as though it's their God-given right to poison the world, and that if we oppose them, then there's something the matter with us because we're denying them their ability to make money. And
going back to this letter, we view the concerns that are raised by these EPA scientists very much like the canary in the mine shaft. In this case, you're hearing the song of 9,000 canaries.
Right, right. Well, that said, tell us how your organization is working toward resolving this. Are you working with mandamus types of suits? Are you working with lawsuits? Or are you simply a megaphone?
We bring lawsuits. One of the big suits we have right now against EPA involves their failure to provide for cleanup rules for lead paint when older homes are repaired or renovated. That loss is going to be taking a fair amount of our time, and this particular pathway is one of the primary sources by which children in the U.S. are exposed to lead. And in many of the larger cities, particularly back here in the East, between 5 and 10% of all the children under age 7 have elevated blood lead levels at levels that are associated with loss of IQ points and alteration of personality. With respect to these organophosphates, we're contemplating doing a suit after the agency decision in August, but the standard is going to be fairly daunting. And so at the moment it's premature to sue because the agency hasn't done anything. These scientists are merely protesting that the basically, they've been told which way the wind is blowing.
Right, right. Well, we already know which way the wind is blowing, and it's an ill wind. So, you know, obviously it's a very smart idea for these scientists to band together because not only will they know who is an ally, but with an organization such as yours, it'll be easier for specialists to interact with each other in a time of crisis. So it's obviously a good idea for an organization like yours to get involved. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure if you're aware of this. I've been involved in Physicians for Social Responsibility for off and on for about 30 years. And even as long ago as 25 and 30 years ago, the unemployment rate of physicians has been rapidly rising. With the problems of medical malpractice insurance rising extremely fast, much faster than a norm, the physicians that were let's say enterprising enough to decide to remain as a sole practitioner and to not join HMOs, they've been getting squeezed out and slowly but surely are not able to financially maintain the insurance policies of medical malpractice. So the unemployment rate of physicians was as high as 20%, something like 12 years ago. And so we actually have this huge unemployment rate of physicians. And it would seem to me that if an organization such as yours was looking for people to help put together some of these studies, it might be a really opportune time to look for some of these unemployed physicians to be taking part in clinic development so that you could put together enough data to be able to clearly not only prove your point, but also to get some of the resolution of this you know, hazmat. One of the really dangerous aspects of this Our Stolen Future book was that if we end up with a lot of people who have ADD at an early age, they're not going to be able to think clearly enough to be able to take part in basic repetitive work, much less to do detailed work like the sciences and the math and the various configurations of complicated cleanups. And so, in other words, if we're getting into a highly poisoned world, we're going to need people with clear minds to be able to clean it up, and the more hazardous waste the children are exposed to, it's going to damage their brains so that they will not be able to focus well enough on it. And so it would seem to me that with this HMO scam that's squeezing the doctors out of the field, they're creating supply and demand medicine. They're firing all of the doctors, and then the remaining doctors that suck up to the HMOs are not only overworked and underpaid, but the charges are going because there are few doctors in those HMOs, and the HMO can cash in. So all of these unemployed doctors, it would seem to me, can be a great asset to to an organization such as yours and some of the others that are working on cleanup?
Perhaps. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, PEER. We're a service organization for people that work inside these agencies. We do a lot of whistleblower work or work to force the release of internal documents. And as you might imagine, particularly during the Bush administration, this is a booming business.
Sure. Yeah.
We have five requests for assistance each day just in our office here in D.C., and we have 10 other offices around the country. So I'm not sure we're in a position to take on new work. Just ministering to what's going on inside these public agencies is a full-time job.
Well, maybe you could get some of these unemployed doctors and researchers as volunteers. So as you were describing, 1,500 chemicals and 365 days a year, five a day, that's just about the...
Right. Most all of our staff and our board are former public employees, scientists, managers, law enforcement officers, even agency lawyers.
Right. And it's interesting, too. I was once on a board in Colorado that was working with police and fire departments to help inform them of where the hazardous wastes were. If a firefighter was to go into a house that had hazardous wastes in them, there used to be a CD-ROM that was available on every fire truck that would tell you a given address, and that if you were going in there to expect benzene or to expect even flammables. And under, well, post 9/11, in the name of not giving the terrorists opportunities to know where targets of opportunity were, they essentially forced every fire department and every police department to turn in those CD-ROMs. And so now the hazardous waste sites that were so such a hard battle to determine, they've all been turned in, or there's been an attempt to get that information turned in.
And yesterday the U.S. Senate in one of the key committees voted to make the release of that sort of information a crime.
Right, right. And so it becomes against the law to save your life. And it's preposterous. The principle of self-defense is in common law, you know.
But even more broadly, it's becoming against the law, or certainly against your self-interest, particularly if you work for a government agency, to tell the truth.
Right, right. It's against, yeah, absolutely. It's preposterous, but, you know, it's obvious that...
And that's the trench line where we work.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's... you know, it's obvious that we know the direction that we have to take this. These people are organized crime. It's actually an interesting dynamic, and this is why I'm so interested in the economics of this, that if we've got global warming, if you were to simply look at it, not necessarily as the responsibility of who did it, but how much is it going to cost to clean it up? There is not enough money on the planet to clean it up. We may have plenty of people willing to clean it up. We may have enough bright minds knowledgeable of how to clean it up and to resolve it. But the money is actually there to tell us that we have to budget it and that we cannot just actively join together as humans with opposable thumbs and creative minds and clever tongues to be able to communicate how to do it, but that if you can't get time on the media to help inform the public how they can take part in it, that it becomes financially it's a financial in the impossibility to save our lives. And so obviously the corporations that have poisoned us have a vested interest in denying that they've ever done it. They cannot admit it because every penny that they've got will have to go toward the cleanup. And obviously their houses on the hill are going to be sold at tax auction in order to pay for it. And nobody wants to give up what they've got, so they'll deny it even though it's the death of the planet. And so we're in a huge trap. The financing is the trap, and since financing is what's bribing Congress, we're in a point of no return of the economics. And until we get some resolution of the economics, obviously the corporations are going to try to create more and more strident and stringent laws to protect their assets from the exposure of the damages that they've committed. Huge trap. Well, tell us if people want to get involved. Do you have chapters around the country? Do you have?
We have one in Sacramento. You can find them all on our website, which is peer.org.
Okay, and if of our listeners, if you've got other scientists, are you looking for volunteers of a certain nature, or are you looking for a good cross section of people?
We're looking for volunteers of all kinds, and also we're a service organization for employees. We're particularly looking for retirees of people that have worked in these agencies that want to work with their colleagues. We find that the model of, if you will, former cancer patients working with cancer survivors working with current cancer patients is a fairly effective one. Retirees make wonderful spokespeople because they're authoritative, but they don't have that much of a risk of retaliation.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a good point. Right. They can speak with authority, and their pensions are already preserved.
But if people are interested in taking a look at, if you will, the ugly undersides of what's going on inside the public agencies, one of the things our organization does is it acts as a huge information laundromat where we are constantly getting material that otherwise isn't seen the light of day, and it's our job to ventilate it. But usually we wash off the fingerprints first.
Well, you know, said, I wonder if you take a look at that, ourstolenfuture.org, and I wonder if some of the studies that are on there, I mean, these are your standard Lancet and Harvard Medical Journal and every major, institution of higher learning.
Primarily working with our agency studies that would be submitted to peer-reviewed journals or otherwise published but are suppressed.
Right, yeah, and so you might actually be able to create whether it's doubling the opportunities or the information on both sites, but it may actually create a flourishing of the information so that it would seem to me that if we got the medical community tied with the scientific community, we'd get a lot better results. And frankly, the economics are so preposterous at this point that it just really makes sense that we should hunker down and save our lives and ignore the economics of it. We're getting into a scenario where they're going to tell us that money is more important than life, and that's just a madness that has no validity in any argument. And you know, if they're going to tell us that it, as you just described,
what these scientists are saying.
Sure. Yeah, it's against the law to save our lives.
The risk to human health is being overlooked, and it's being overlooked for economic reasons.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So it's against the law to save our lives. Well, that's preposterous. We don't need to listen to that. So.
But I will check that out, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, no trouble. So again, we've been speaking with Jeff Rook of Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, and their website again is peer.org, P-E-E-R, and go to it if you are of if your background. It sounds like there, if your background is in environmental law, in environmental studies. Probably medicine would be helpful, even if you've got just basic secretarial skills. I'm sure you could be the detail work, the research, and filing is of immense importance to many of these future studies as well as the lawsuits. I would expect that you're also looking for a number of good attorneys that are experienced in environmental law as well, right?
Yes.
Sure. So a lot of opportunity out there. Let's say pollution is creating a lot of jobs. So.
Well, thank you again.
Hey, no trouble. Thanks again, Jeff.
All right.
And, yeah, we'd like to do another interview maybe in about 6 months or something, see how things are going.
Okay.
All right. Thanks again.
All right.
So, again, Jeff Rook with Peer. And, again, if you want to get involved, P-E-E-R. And this is just one more of the madhouses that we're getting walked into. So you're listening to Indie Bay Radio in San Francisco. A little more of Miles Davis, Bitches Brew.